Okay, any housekeeping issues? What's that? Oh, I don't have a seating chair. As long as you can get along with one another, don't make me know, never mind. Any other housekeeping questions? Okay. We left off yesterday talking about the standard of reasonable care and the way in which it incorporates. Oh, yes, ma'am. Oh, you can't? Okay, we'll talk a little louder then. We left off yesterday talking about the standard of reasonable care and the way in which a reasonable person takes into account not only the potential for safety, but also the cost of additional safety. And essentially, in Adams versus Bullock, Cardozo said as a matter of law, in that particular case, it would be nice to have a system that didn't pose the risk of harm to the plaintiff, but it would come at too high a price. And therefore, it wasn't something you could expect the defendant. That kind of injury was not one that you could expect the defendant to try to prevent. Now, the next case that we have deals with a slightly different issue within this definition of reasonable care, how we incorporate the fact that some people don't have the same level of ability, in this case because of their youth. How does that affect our expectation of them? And then we'll move on to look at a different way of understanding the standard of reasonable care. And just so we're sort of clear at this introductory level, I would refer to this section as what I call the intuitive understanding of reasonable care. It's what a reasonable person would do. And when we move into the next section with United States versus Carroll Towing, it's more the heading of it basically is efficiency. That is, we decide things on the basis of what promotes the best use of resources. And the question is, what's the relationship between the sort of intuitive understanding that the one we judge a person's behavior swatting at a wasp, we compare that to the standard of what we expect of some hypothetical reasonable person, whereas when we're talking about whether or not somebody should have had a bargee aboard this barge, the standard is one based upon, well, what's the best, most efficient allocation, resource allocation formula. But anyway, we'll get there to Carroll Towing after we finish with the snowmobile case and the question of what to do when the defendant is not an adult. Mr. Graves, why don't you tell us about Robinson versus Lindsay? Okay. So the plaintiff is injured after riding with the defendant's on the defendant's snowmobile, and she wants him to compensate her for the injuries that she suffered. What happens when the case goes to trial? I don't think so. I actually think the verdict was for the defendant, wasn't it? Yeah, for the guy who was driving the snowmobile, and the verdict was against the girl who's lost her thumb, who's trying to get compensation. Okay, but then you said the trial judge had a change of heart. What's the trial judge's reconsideration of this, or where is what the go ahead. Okay. Okay, so let's be clear about the instruction that the jury was actually given at the trial was what, ladies and gentlemen of the jury? You should find this guy negligent if... Okay, if he met the standard of a reasonably prudent 13-year-old, then... he's not negligent. And that's incorrect according to the plaintiff and now the trial judge, because the standard should have been, the instruction should have been what? Or leaving out the word adult. Yeah, a reasonably prudent person. So without qualifying, this person is 13 years old. We say, consider what level of care a reasonably prudent person would use driving a snowmobile, not taking into account the fact that this person happened to be 13. Okay. Now, before we look at this particular situation, let's see if there are cases where we would, in fact, modify the standard to say, in considering whether the defendant acted negligently, you should compare the defendant's conduct to that of a reasonably prudent 13-year-old, 10-year-old, or whatever. Give me a sort of hypothetical or fact scenario in which that would be an appropriate thing to do. Actually, that's where they applied an adult standard. You give me an example of where they would have properly applied a child standard. I'm not sure there are any that are specifically mentioned in the case, but can you think of an example of where some defendant gets sued? Yeah. Okay, but that's where he causes injury to himself. Can you think of a situation in which he caused injury to somebody else? Yeah. Okay, so if you had a 13-year-old who's, let's say, riding his bicycle down the street and somebody is trying to cross the street and he runs into them. And the person he runs into gets injured, you know, gets a broken arm or loses their thumb or what have you, and sues this kid and says, you were negligent in riding your bicycle and I want you to pay my damages. In that case, the jury would be told, in considering whether the defendant was negligent, you should compare his behavior or consider whether he behaved or met the standard of a reasonably prudent 13-year-old. What's the difference? What does it make a difference whether you lose your thumb because of a bicycle or a snowmobile? More, okay, and in part to sort of see what we're doing here, as we formulate the rule, as we categorize things into one heading which says, these activities are subject to the standard of a reasonably prudent child, like riding a bicycle, playing catch out in front of your house. I'm walking down the street, there are two 13-year-old boys throwing a ball back and forth, and one of them throws it, and it hits me in the head. If I want to get damages for that injury, get compensation for it, I have to prove that they didn't live up to the standard of a reasonably prudent 13-year-old. So there's some things we put over in this category, And there are some things we put over in this category, which I forget whether we've gotten to that point yet, but we wind up putting snowmobiling in that category. With respect to those activities, the child is not allowed, in effect, to enjoy the slack we would cut for the fact that this person is only 13. Been okay for a 13-year-old. We say, look, you're held to the standard of a reasonably prudent person. Notice that what we're doing is we're saying, with respect to some activities, for example, if I'm walking down the street and I see a bunch of kids playing catch, I'm not necessarily thinking about this as, I mean, it happens that I would think about this, but the ordinary person, the normal person wouldn't. You wouldn't think, well, gee, well, the liability rules here, well, but what society does by adopting this rule is to say, in effect, it's my job as an adult to look out for my own safety. All that I can expect of these kids playing catch or the kid on a bicycle is that they behave in an age-appropriate way. If the kid's riding his bicycle on a sidewalk and I come out of a store, walk onto the sidewalk, and this kid runs over me, I could still say, hey, look, even though you're only 13, you should know you shouldn't ride down the sidewalk when people are going to walk out the door of a store and get run over without being able to see you. That's a negligent thing to do even for a 13-year-old. But if these kids are playing catch, it's my job, in effect, to recognize, hey, they're only 13 years old. They're not always as good at catching the ball as they think they are. They don't always exercise good judgment about how hard to throw it or to wait till I pass by before they, you know, resume their game. So it's my job to look out for them over here, but it's their job, in effect, if you're riding a snowmobile, as the saying goes, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. If you're not prepared to live up to the level of a reasonably prudent person, don't drive a snowmobile. So, again, one of the functions of the tort system is to allocate these burdens of who's got to look out for whom. And what is the advantage of allocating the burden in those cases where they're playing catch or riding the bicycle? Why would we not adopt a higher standard that would provide more protection for society? Is it similarly unrealistic to expect that a 13-year-old would exercise an adult's prudence in driving a snowmobile? Okay, so one of the ways we like this division is the fact that we still let kids be kids. And in fact, in a way, we sort of give this social indulgence. We say to the adults walking past the kids playing catch, adult, if you don't want to get hit with a baseball, you know, if you can't stand the heat, stay out of the kitchen. You keep your close eye on these kids while they're playing catch. That's the way we're going to avoid your getting injured. As opposed to saying to the kids, it's your job to avoid injuring the adult. Again, we still have a standard of reasonable care even within that parameter, but again, thinking about the function of the tort system in terms of allocating burdens, we like allocating the burden to the adult world to let kids be kids. That's an important thing to do. We want them to play catch, to ride their bicycle, to do things that are normal to children. But it's not asking too much, so this rule would suggest, it's not asking too much that when the child ventures into those activities, that discrete set of activities that are primarily engaged in by adults, operating dangerous machinery, where the child's sort of on notice that I'm temporarily entering the adult world, I can return to the world of being a child, but I'm temporarily entering this world. While I'm in that world, I'm held to a higher standard. And that provides a greater level of protection. I can notice that the kids playing catch out in front of my house are only 10 or 13 years old. I can take that into account as I exercise greater caution for my own safety. I can't tell a kid who's dressed in a winter snowmobile suit with a helmet on, oh, that's a 13-year-old. I gotta be a little more cautious as I encounter him. Now, it turns out the girl who's the passenger in this case did know that he was 13, but even at that, the standard remains the one determined by the nature of his activity. And again, the court's thinking more generally about people under the age of 18 who are driving cars, or people, as in Delwell versus Pearson, who are driving a powerboat. In those circumstances, we want the people who impose this risk on others without others being able to identify them as children and take appropriate evasive maneuvers. Because we don't have the ability to do that, we want to provide a greater level of protection. Mr. Viviano? I don't know what the, it sometimes will happen that, for example, there's another party in the case. Maybe, for example, the person who rented the snowmobile, or, there's some other party named Lindsay. Or it may be that, the person who supplied the snowmobile, whether it's the parents or some third party that rented the snowmobile to the kid, may be liable under a theory called negligent entrustment, which is it's a theory where you say, in effect, if I give some dangerous thing, a car or a knife or a chainsaw, to a person that I have reason, a reasonable person would recognize an unsuitable recipient of this dangerous thing because they're intoxicated or because they're not old enough to handle it or they have some other characteristic that makes it unsuitable, then you can use this idea of negligent entrustment to make the supplier of this dangerous thing liable for what's later done by the person to whom it's entrusted. Mr. Reichert? Right. Well, my guess is that a court navigating its way through this distinction, and you could set up a spectrum of activities that would have playing catch and riding a bicycle over at this end, and piloting a Black Hawk helicopter over here, you can have just I can keep shading it, moving it one way or the other, so that I add little. You got a scooter, then you got a scooter with a motor on it, then you've got this. You've got a blender, you've got a table saw, you've got a chainsaw, you've got a this, you've got a that. Each little increment would push you one way or the other. My guess is that a court navigating its way through cases deciding which activities belong over here and which activities belong over there will take into account both the level of danger presented by the activity. Are we talking about something that's really dangerous, that causes lots of injuries, or are we talking about something that's relatively harmless, like a blender or a power drill or a weed eater or something like that? And the court would also take into account the likelihood that in using this activity, the person likely to be injured had a way of identifying, oh, this is a youthful user of it. So I would say a weed eater, you know, a kid who's trimming lawns with a weed eater, would probably not fall into the adult activity category, not only because weed eaters are less likely, you can get hurt with a weed eater. It might pick something up and throw it at somebody. And so a kid who's using one of these things or fire a bunch of debris and hit somebody in the eye, that it could be dangerous, but the level of danger is lower, and it's easier for me as I'm walking by to see this is a 13-year-old kid. And in that respect, it's not that much different from playing catch. So again, the court's process of sorting out what activities fall within the adult activity, adult standard of care, I think I was pointing the wrong direction, it's over here, and the ones that are more like a childlike activity and should be held to a child age appropriate standard would be based on considering both factors. Dangerousness of the activity, potential for harm, as well as likelihood that the victim could identify this person and take evasive action. Mr. Johnson? Well, oftentimes the child is covered by an insurance policy. So if I own a powerboat or a snowmobile, I may very well have insurance either for that particular vehicle that covers all the permissive users of that vehicle, or I may have some additional coverage like homeowners coverage that would provide the children in my household are covered under my homeowners. So there's oftentimes insurance that will cover damage caused by a child. Not necessarily. Well, it wouldn't go to their parents. It would go to the Well, it's not so much that the owner of the machine is liable. I just want to be clear about there is something called vicarious liability. We'll talk about it at the end of the section on negligence, whereby I make, for example, an employer liable for the negligence of an employee. And I say, okay, the truck driver for Safeway who cut me off and got into an accident, I don't want to, even though it was the truck driver who was negligent, I want Safeway to pay for the injury. In the case of a child who causes the injury, I'm not saying, well, their parents are vicariously liable, or the owner of the machine is vicariously liable. That's not necessarily true. But I am saying there may be insurance that has been purchased that includes the child as one of the people for whom insurance coverage is being provided. So if they are found negligent, the insurance coverage applies to them. Okay. Now, as I said, we do want to move on and talk about United States versus Carroll Towing, because it proposes a different way of thinking about the problem that and we have to evaluate what we think about the how persuasive you find this proposition that this is the way we ought to think about it. Ms. Chan, can you tell us about United States versus Carroll Towing? Okay, so one of the one of the people who's trying to recover damages is the, I guess, the owner of the cargo, the owner of the United States who owned the flour. And in addition to the other people that caused the collision, those people want to bring in the owner of the barge and say the barge owner's negligence also should be part of the mix in allocating fault. So how does Learned Hand, and what is it the barge owner did that was negligent? Yeah, a so-called bargee. I don't know what if there's a barger, but there is a bargee, and it's the question whether a reasonable person would have had a bargee on board that Learned Hand is trying to answer. And how does he propose that we think about this problem, apparently not just here, but in general, if the question before the House is, was this person negligent, he's saying that you can answer that question, in effect, by expressing it in the form of an equation. What's his equation? That's, yeah. What are these three variables? Let's take this one at a time. The first one is the probability of an accident, in effect, which is in this equation represented by P. What other? Which in the equation is expressed by what? Variable? L. So sometimes people think this is liability, but it actually stands for loss, in particular the magnitude of the loss, which we could express in terms of dollars. So in this, we're trying to figure out, okay, if an accident happens, what are we talking about here? Is this a barge carrying refuse that's going to be hauled out to sea and dumped? And if we lose it in the harbor, well, that's a bad thing, but it's not like we really wanted it anyway. Or is this a barge that's full of, you know, priceless, you know, antiques or you know, some extremely valuable cargo that would be a terrible tragedy to lose? Or is it something like flour, which is, yeah, it's valuable, but it's not irreplaceable? Okay, what's the other variable we want to take into account? Okay, and what is the relationship between, expressed in this equation, between these variables? Yeah. Or the way he expresses it, is B less than P times L? The concept here being that if we could quantify what the burden is, we should compare that to the likelihood of injury multiplied by the magnitude of the injury. Now, again, just so we're clear here, what is it that this equation is supposed to tell us? What good does it do us to run this equation? Or if they were negligent, right? And somebody is negligent if what? If the burden is, yeah. In other words, if you could have cheaply avoided the accident, if there was some modest burden you could have taken, and that was less than the anticipated likelihood that something bad was going to happen, multiplied by the scale of damages, the magnitude of the loss, then a reasonable person would have undertaken the burden. In this case, we're talking about a bargee. What does it cost to keep a bargee on board? And we're never actually given these figures. Learned of Hand doesn't actually run the numbers here, but he's saying this is the way you ought to think about it. And he says, well, you know, one of the difficulties of actually employing this kind of formula is that it's a constantly changing scenario. During the day, for example, the probability of harm, he says, is much higher because there's a lot of activity during the day. People are moving these barges around. At night, the harbor slows down a little bit. Maybe it's not worth it to have a bargee on board at night because the probability of harm drops as the activity in the harbor drops. Similarly, if it's wartime and there's a lot of, you know, sort of frantic activity going on, perhaps a lot of, you know, inexperienced people or novel kinds of things going on, the advantage of having somebody around to kind of monitor the situation would be higher than in peacetime when there's less traffic and the people who are doing it are more kind of old hands at it. Again, you would have the greater incentive to have a bargee on board if you were carrying some priceless treasure compared to a barge full of refuse that was being towed for disposal. So let's just sort of, again, run the numbers. Let's suppose it costs $50 to have a bargee on board. And supposing during the day the probability of an accident is 1 in 100. And suppose the value of the cargo you're carrying is $10,000. Would a reasonable person have a bargee on board? According to these numbers, yes. The discounted magnitude of, you know, 1 in 100 times $10,000 is a net $100. That's more than the cost of having a bargee on board. Similarly, again, if you change this, as Learned Hand says, it's one thing to have a bargee on board most of the time. You know, if you could hire somebody who'd be there during the busy hours, but you let them go, you know, into town at night, you don't want to make them a prisoner of the barge, as he says. That would be very expensive. You'd have to pay dearly to have someone who never left the barge. That would be too expensive, but having somebody there during daylight hours would be less. Okay, so if we see kind of the way this thing works, the way this formula works, it's time to kind of evaluate the formula. Should we, you know, like John Nash, you know, give him the Nobel Prize for economics here? Is he's got this conceptual breakthrough here to help us think about tort liability, or is this a kind of a little sideshow here? How do we evaluate the usefulness of this as a tool in evaluating whether somebody has used reasonable care or not? Anybody have a sense as to how Mr. McElvaina? Okay, but what about, I mean, it sounds like you're endorsing this as a way for us to think about, and maybe it's a great way to think about barges, but the question is, to what extent is it applicable in other kinds of cases, Mr. King? Okay. Okay, and And I guess the argument would be that we do the best we can as we muddle through in life, anticipating relative risks, so that if I have a two-year-old that's supposed to be in a car seat, but I swapped cars with my mother-in-law and the car with the car seat's over at her house and I've got her car, which doesn't have a car seat, I really need to get to the store to, you know, buy something for breakfast tomorrow. Oh, what the heck. I'll strap Junior in the back seat, run to the store, I'll, you know, be careful doing that, and get back. You know, the probability of my getting into an accident is low. Well, I don't know how I would assess how I'd feel if it turned out I got into an accident because my kid didn't have a car seat. He got seriously injured that a car seat would have prevented. But, you know, the burden at this point of, what am I supposed to go around the neighborhood and see if somebody has a, come on. I make an assessment in my head. Right now, it's okay. I don't like to do this generally. Don't get me wrong. But on this particular occasion, I'm going to put the kid in the back seat with a seatbelt, hope he doesn't squirm out of the seatbelt. I'm going to drive to the store, get something for breakfast, and get home. Without thanking Learned Hand for it, I've engaged in a, you know, comparison of what I think is the probability of harm. Am I going to drive across country? No. But I am going to drive to the store, you know, that's 2 miles away and hope the Child Protective Services people don't spot me before I get home. Now, the argument would be that even without having the data in hand, you know, and punching it into my little the calculator that my cell phone has is one of its little features, you know, that I can, it's got a little calculator there and I could punch these numbers. I don't have the data on the likelihood I'm going to be in an accident, and I don't know how, but I'm doing this stuff in my head sort of on the fly. I'm making a judgment, and a Learned Hand would say, in effect, that's what you and I do all the time. We're doing this stuff. Yeah, Mr. Brown. What do you mean by a commercial application? Okay. Okay, but let me give you an example of how this was done, but not everybody was happy about the way it was done. It's a case that actually comes up in Chapter 3. It's the Ford Pinto case, where Ford's engineers discovered they're putting out this car for the first time. Really, they're caught in a sort of catch-up mode. Imported cars that are smaller and more fuel efficient are taking a larger and larger share of the car market. They don't want to lose any more of the market share, so they come up with this idea, we'll make our own smaller fuel efficient car. So they downsize, you know, the various features of the car. They put the prototype together, they start testing the prototype, and one of the things they discover, they actually are anticipating that not that model year, but in the next model year, they will have to meet a standard of rear crash avoidance or impact. So they run these low-speed rear-end collision simulators or you know, crash tests, and they discover, to their disappointment, that the way they've engineered the gas tank and the size of the car at 25 miles an hour, a significant number of the cars develop. The fuel tank gets ruptured and fuel gets spilled, creating a significant fire hazard. So the engineers, being in a commercial environment, start looking at the data. First of all, they figure out let's figure out a cheap way to do this. So they come up with something called a nylon bladder, just a a skin that goes on the inside of the tank to keep it from, even if the gas, the metal part gets punctured, the nylon bladder will keep the contents of the gas from spilling out. So, but that's going to cost us $11 to insert that in the line of vehicles that we're going to make. They look at the probability, and they've got data, and they figure out it's, you know, whatever it is, 00005 or something. So there's a bunch of strings of zeros before they get to the number of cars that roll off the assembly line that they know from data will be involved in rear-end collisions at 25 miles or greater. Now, the tough part, the last one, what's it worth? Well, that's what they figure. But they're at some sense, they're supposed to figure out what it's worth. In effect, they say, well, just how bad is that? What should we use as the magnitude of loss? And where would they go to get the data on what a serious burn injury or burn death, what kind of a figure we should put there? Where do they go? Or they go actually to the lawyers, in effect. They go look up jury verdicts. They go to previous jury awards. And they've got, you know, a bank of data there. And they come up with a number, $300,000. That's the average award in a serious burn injury or death. And I don't have this number correct, but whatever the number was, when they ran it, the burden was too high. It wasn't worth it, they figured, relative to the low probability that any individual car would be in an accident and using that figure. So the question is, did they do wrong? The jury thought so. The jury not only thought they were negligent, they were horrified. They awarded damages to the plaintiff and then tacked on a $125 million punitive damage award, saying, in effect, what were you thinking? And the engineers might have come back and said, learn at hand. That's where we learned this. Don't be so shocked here. We just did. Now, and so the question is, were they, you know, is learned hand wrong? Did they misapply the formula? Was the jury wrong? What should we think about this? Okay, but he's using his own method. And the question is, should the engineers at Ford have used his method, or should they have thought, oh, no, not here? Ms. Connor-Dudley? Oh, okay, but were you shocked when I gave you that hypothetical story of a parent who threw his kid into the back seat of the car and put a seatbelt on and didn't put the kid in the car seat, and in their mind said, well, the burden is, in effect, ran the learned hand test in their head and said, burden is too great, even though it involved the value of human life, my own child. I still figure, well, sometimes the burden is too great to exert that high a level of safety.
No, I mean, there's a lot of people who say a lot of people think. I don't think it's a
Does anybody think that that was a wise decision? Yes, sir. Right. Okay. And just so we clue everybody else in on this grand philosophical discussion, you have a tradition, a philosophical tradition, often associated with Immanuel Kant, the deontologist, the guy who thought that morality was composed of duties that paid little heed to consequences, but looked at the act itself. And said, in effect, you can't justify, the end doesn't justify the means. Acts are good or bad in themselves. You can't rationalize them by saying, oh, I don't like this particular means, but look at the good end that it serves. Okay? So that's a Kantian tradition. By contrast, you have a utilitarian tradition that says, cut it out with all this philosophical mumbo-jumbo. What makes acts good or bad is whether they lead to good or bad consequences. It's the greatest good for the greatest number. And if the action you want to take is going to result in a lot of human misery, it's a bad act. And if what you want to do is going to result in a lot of human benefit, it's a good act. That's the way you judge the rightness or the wrongness of an act. So the tension between this so-called, again, just sort of to have labels to put on these, the Kantian tradition and the utilitarian tradition, it's an old fight. Now, I don't want to reduce this to simply a replay of that old fight, but there is a certain correspondence here between this kind of intuitive notion, what a reasonable person, negligence is the failure to use reasonable care, that sort of intuitive thing. I'm not necessarily saying it's, you know, Kantian, but I'm also pointing out there's another tradition, sort of utilitarian tradition, that says what makes something reasonable or unreasonable is looking at the downstream consequences. And if the consequences can be, reasonably explained, that makes it good. So, I just wanted to sort of make sure everybody was in the same sphere here, looking at this philosophical tradition. Now that we have acknowledged this is an old fight, what say you about how the law should either side with one or the other in that fight? In a way, but how should we instruct the jury? Should we instruct the jury using a learned hand formula? Should we instruct the jury not to use a learned hand formula? How do we shape the way the jury thinks about it? Well, you'd make a good politician. In the sense that you don't want to have to choose between these two appealing concepts. And I would say, in fact, our legal system, the tort system, has not clearly gone off in this direction or gone off in that direction. When we're talking about wasps flying into people's cars, we don't pull out the learned hand formula. On the other hand, if we are talking about particularly an industrial process, if we're trying to decide whether a reasonable person would have used 5/16 bolts or 3/8 bolts to secure the joints between these metal panels in a storage building, then we start looking at, well, okay, how much more would it cost to use 3/8 bolts instead of 5/16 bolts? What additional safety benefit does that provide? How bad would it be if it turned out the smaller size failed? It doesn't seem unnatural or wrong to apply the learned hand mode of thinking. We assume that engineers all the time are sort of factoring in, where do I put my resources? Where do I tweak this or tweak that? But there's also a point at which you would hope the engineers at Ford and their managers would have recognized what was I thinking there? That even if it's expensive to put that safety feature into the car, it isn't just the equation you ought to consult. You should ask a question like, would I feel comfortable having my kids ride in the back seat of that car? Or would I, not my kids. I'll put them in a Ford Galaxy or, you know, some other car that I know has been engineered to. Maybe there's some folks out there that are, you know, choosing between a Volkswagen Beetle and a, you know, a Datsun and a, you know, Toyota, and they'll choose the Ford Pinto, and they're kind of all the same. But I know that those things aren't really very safe. If that's the way you're thinking, this sort of intuitive thing. So again, I think in real life, most of us have certain areas of sort of pragmatic decision making. Some things are, six of one, half a dozen of the other. It's all a matter of, you know, the cheapest way to get from here to there. There are other areas of our life in which we are Kantians. We say, basically, I don't do that. Or, I do that. And not because, and this particular part of my life is, in effect, not for sale. No matter how much you offer me. You say, well, look at the benefit you could gain from just setting aside that little scruple of yours over here. And most of us know ourselves well enough to recognize we don't do very well under those circumstances. We need to have these sort of clear boundaries which basically say, I don't do that. And so, again, this, I would say, your political answer, if that's not a demeaning term there, is in fact the one that the legal system lives with, which is this sort of an ambivalent, you know, at times I'm a pragmatist, and at times I say no to that. Anyway, we'll pick that up again on Monday.